On this beautiful day, James was with our flock of sheep and goats in the foothills outside the city. The weather was balmy with a blue sky and a light, warm breeze. I discovered James resting near an outcrop of rock while the herd grazed nearby. He was glad to see me, and we ate together, drinking in turns from the jug of wine. We were on the edge of a valley and had an unsurpassed view of Ascalon and the seashore upon which the city lies. After we finished the food, James, inflamed by the wine and the beauty of the day, and I think also by my face and body, became aroused and began to kiss and fondle me, making me want to howl with need for him. Our desire became so strong that, as we were alone in the grazing land, I took off all my clothes and gave myself to my husband lying there on the hard earth. The warmth of the day, the fact that we lay in the open air, together with the effect of the wine upon my senses, gave me an unusual thrill, and when we reached the pinnacle of desire, I cried out loudly with the joy of it. Later we talked, and I considered that I was the luckiest woman in Ascalon to have such a husband. At the time, we neither knew, nor would we have cared, that some of the older men from the city had hidden among the bushes to spy upon us, seeing everything we did with each other. Even when we'd finished, we did not bother to dress, but lay naked on the ground, clinging to each other. Later on the same day, after I'd gone back to our small house, these same older men brought me the news that James had been bitten by a viper as he was moving the herd to higher grazing. Some of the younger men carried him in from the herd, and I tried to clean out the bite, but the poison from the snake was already so well established in his body that he died as the sun went down. The snake had been young and its poison strong, and the shock so great to my poor husband's body. We buried James the next day, and I was almost mad with grief. Yet this was nothing compared with the sorrows to come. I was melancholy, downcast, lamenting and weeping as I sat with the other women mourning the death of my husband, as the men took his body for burial, as is the custom. However, in the midst of all this anguish, the leaders of the community came into the house, together with James's mother, and pointed at me, declaring that my husband's death was my fault. One by one, they accused me of being wanton, immodest, and lascivious. They spoke of seeing James and me in the open air, behaving, as they said, like beasts of the field. I had led my husband into wicked, carnal ways, they claimed, and denounced me, saying I'd filled James's mind with sinful depravity, so that he could not look to the safety of the flock, and indeed the safety of himself, so that the poisonous snake had caught him unawares. His mother said, had he been of normal mind, he would never have been bitten by the snake. I had bewitched his mind, she said, using terrible spells and incantations. It would not have surprised me if they'd accused me of being some kind of devil. This was not simply his mother's grief, trying to find someone to blame for her son's death. I was certain this was the work of the elders poisoning James's mother's mind, just as the snake had poisoned my poor husband. Later, when I was in Hebron, I met a woman I'd known in Ascalon, and she told me that James's young brother, scarcely 12 years old, had been betrothed to the girl Sarah, and the whole of our flock given over to them. In the meantime, the sheep and goats were being looked after by Sarah's father, and the corn seen to by an uncle. They'd finally got what they wanted, and at the time I could do nothing but flee from the city. If I'd stayed, they would certainly have sentenced me to death, and I would have been dragged out to the cliff by the sea and stoned. Charlie Gauntlet looked out of the window, down to the roiling, dark clouds spread out below at 20,000 feet, with the sun hanging bright in the canopy of sky above. What a sad little tale, he thought. He also wondered how the monks were affected by reading of Naomi's sexual cavorting. A flight attendant, slick in her neat uniform skirt and shirt, sashayed down the aisle. As she paused to bend and speak to a passenger, the material of her skirt pulled tight across her buttocks, giving Gauntlet a pleasant little frisson of the loins. Aloud, in his head, he said, "No, Charles, this is politically not correct." It was all so real that he thought for a moment he'd actually spoken aloud, for the young woman turned back and looked at him. He asked for a coffee, and she brought it with a foil packet of peanuts, smiling her nice, stern flight attendant smile that made him feel slightly ashamed. In his head, he had just about committed adultery with her. It made him feel guilty, as though he'd been unfaithful to Bex already. He was missing her more than he ever thought possible. Charlie had been brought up in that somewhat cold, stiff upper lip school of the British upper middle classes, and many of the feelings he was coming up against now were journeys into unfamiliar territory. He sighed, then turned the page, and continued to read. After I fled from Ascalon, I came to Hebron with nothing but a few coins and the clothes in which I travelled. It was here in Hebron that I met Romilius, who befriended me and suggested that I should sell my body and be a harlot. I had no wish to do this, but neither did I want to beg on the streets, starve, or do menial tasks, which was the only other way I could have kept my body and soul together. In the end, Romilius prevailed. I was in dreadful need of money for food and clothes, so I gave myself to the centurion, who promised to instruct me in the ways of whoredom. He knows much about women and the many tricks they can use to please men, so I soon learned that men are possessed of incredible imaginations. You cannot put boundaries on a man's imagination, and I should think that you could not prescribe a woman's either. I learned many strange things from this soldier, who had travelled all over the empire that is ruled from Rome. As a young legionnaire, he had served in Gaul and lived in Britannia. Romilius told me about his travels, of how wild and brutal some lands could be, and how hostile. Even so, he had experienced much at the hands of women. There were stories about some of the women warriors who became willing partners to soldiers in places like the north of Gaul. It had taken many years for the women to be trusted, for in the early days they would feign friendship, hiding a knife or similar cutting instrument near the bed. Then later, when they had a soldier in thrall with the wiles of their body, they would unsex him with the knife and run away, hiding in the woods, where they had to be hunted down like animals. Romilius taught me that both men and women will be excited by many odd and different things. There is no sense to this. Some even enjoy pain, humiliation, and religious-like rituals in which they are bound with cords and ropes. I remembered something of this when James had beaten me after I'd kissed and sucked at him. He had pretended to be stern, but at the same time he became very aroused. I recalled that I did also. It is strange, the imaginings of men and women, and the way in which these thoughts will set fire to desire. The centurion, who is a senior officer, told me of many things that I could hardly believe, but later I found them to be true. He taught me the ways in which I could stimulate men, using my fingers and palms, also my tongue and mouth. Lying with him, I soon learned that men could be excited by touch, and he showed me the various places on the male body that are sensitive to stroking and pressure with the fingertips. I had long known that men could be stimulated by what a woman wore or how she smelled. Romilius, whom I now loved with a depth I had never thought to feel again, instructed me with regard to unguents and scents, bathing oils, and even clothes. He gave me items of clothing made of soft material, even silks, which made me feel like a woman of great riches. He explained to me that some men enjoyed undressing a woman. Sometimes they would get more pleasure from this than the complete act of loving. These things were all new to me, things I neither knew nor could even guess at. Yet Romilius is a keeper of secrets. Gauntlet sat up and began to take notice, wondering if this was the start of a revelation that had been hinted at by Kit Palfrey. Later on the day, he'd visited Dolphin Square. Palfrey had admitted there was another reason why he'd chosen Charlie to confide in. "So, you saw me at the opera and thought you'd like to talk to me for old time's sake, huh?" "Something like that." Palfrey gave Charlie a quick, lopsided, quirky smile, then repeated in Cockney, "Sonic like that?" "Oh, yeah, sure, Kit. I wouldn't believe you if you swore it on a stack of Bibles." Palfrey went silent and became very still. Gauntlet remembered moments from the past, clearly recalling Kit Palfrey going still and silent, just as he had now. Whenever Kit went like this, it was always the precursor to a revelation. So Charlie jumped in with both feet and Total Recall into the bargain. I can't believe you, Kit. Couldn't believe you if you paid me $1 million. It's what deceit does in the end.